Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Well, welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. I hope that you're staying dry wherever you are this afternoon as the weather closes in on us. It's been an interesting weekend, hasn't it? And I think we have a very interesting show for you today. We're going to talk about a book that is now available, a real good-looking cover on this book and some pretty good information inside. And the title, I think, speaks volumes if this is your cup of tea. It's called A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation. Which generation is he talking about? Which one do you think? This is Hometown Heroes, after all, where we speak with World War II veterans each and every week. And this week, I'm joined by the author of that book, Richard A. Johansen, whose friends know him as Dick. And Dick, thanks for being here today.
Well, Paul, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to being with you.
Yeah, it's good to catch up a little bit. You know, I started that series on TV about 3 years ago with World War II veterans, Stories of Service, and about 6 months in, Art Hill, who runs the museum downtown, the Veterans Memorial Museum and the Legion of Valor. He's one of your fellow Rotarians, and he brought me down to Rotary. I got to meet you and a few other Rotarians and listen to some of your stories from World War II. We put a little story on TV at that point. And I don't know if I did your story justice. I'm sure that I didn't fit everything that's in this book into that short story on TV, so we have a lot to expand on today. But before we get to talking to Dick, I thought it would be appropriate to give a little listen to that initial story that we did with him on the TV side and just give all of our listeners a little taste of what he's been through, what he's experienced, and what you have in store in this hour.
I had graduated from high school at 16, and World War II had just started, and after I had finished 1 year at the university, I realized that I wanted to get into the service.
With the blessing of his mother and father, Dick Johansen entered the Marine Corps on his 18th birthday in December of 1943.
So I reported into San Francisco, was sworn in, and went down to San Diego. Went through boot camp there. After that, I was assigned to become a radioman to learn code, which I did. And at the end of about a year's training, I was assigned to the Marine Corps headquarters in Pearl Harbor.
Listening to Morse code, Dick would type the message into blocks of letters. It needed to be precise and accurate to be decoded down the line, so there was little room for error.
You know, you couldn't call back to Washington, D.C., and please repeat the message. A little PFC out here in Pearl Harbor messed it up. So you really did make an effort to get it the way it needed to be.
But on April 12th, 1945, came an announcement that needed no translation, no code, just plain English from the Secretary of the Navy.
And his message, and I'll never forget it, he's, I regret to announce that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt died today. And Harry S. Truman has been sworn in as his replacement. So that was kind of, in my own little tiny world in the Marine Corps, was a little bit historic to be able to type that message out in Pearl Harbor. It was interesting because by the time that I'd finished typing that message, people came out of the woodwork, and I never saw so many majors and colonels in all my life standing behind my shoulder.
Dick feels fortunate he was never on the front lines. He was about a month away from being sent there when the war came to an end. He remained in the Marines after war's end and put his radio experience to use as the news editor for the Armed Forces radio station in Tsingtao, China. Now, 60 years later, Dick looks back with respect and appreciation at a generation of men and women who epitomized service and sacrifice.
There was a unity in the country that I miss seeing sometimes now. I don't know if we will get there again. I would hope we can, because it was a very, very difficult time in the life of this country. But in some ways, I think it defined who we are and what we believe in and what we would like to see in the world.
Well, I don't think we need to do the rest of the show. You just hit the nail on the head right there with those comments from a couple of years ago. And it strikes me that the last thing we heard in that piece is kind of the genesis behind this book that you've written now, A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation. It seems to me, and I'll let you tell me in your own words, but it seems to me that you're trying to impart on future generations what you think it is about your generation that made it successful and what you hope future generations can strive for that will go beyond even what your generation has achieved. Am I getting that right?
That, Paul, that was kind of the genesis of this particular book. I was urged to write it because of, you know, just my time in life when I was, I'm old enough to have been in a depression and went through World War II and we went through the post-war years and the country was pretty well together. And unfortunately, the Vietnam era came along and kind of created a fracture in our country. And so the purpose of the book in its own tiny, small way is that perhaps we can figure out a way to recreate the aura we had before that. And I realize you can't go back. You can only go forward. But if we can move forward and get back in this spirit of national unity we enjoyed in the 40s and the 50s and 60s and even in the 30s when this country was in a terrible, terrible depression, that will be a great accomplishment for us, I think.
You're not declaring your candidacy now, are you?
No, I'm not.
Too late to get you on the ballot.
No, not anymore.
We won't get into those characters.
Right.
And how'd you find this great-looking young blonde-haired kid for the cover of your book?
Well, I was as we developed the book and we developed the title, and then Dr. John Bogart helped me considerably in with the doing the editing and putting it together. And then he asked me for some pictures of me when I was a kid and at other points in my life. And I think you asked me for some when we did our little TV segment.
I did, and I got some I didn't see this one.
No, but anyhow, this is one of them I gave him. And Dr. Bogart's daughter, Allison, did the graphics for the cover. And she spotted this picture and figured out this would be something to put on the front with myself as probably a 5 or 6 year old sitting on the fender of my dad's Standard Oil truck on the top part, and then a picture of submarines about to go over the side of the ship to begin an invasion on the lower part. I think that was the span that was effective when we created the cover for the book. So.
Well, it's got a really great look, and people, if you want to take a look at it right now, you can see that cover online. You can even order the book online at valleyhistory.org. That's because Dick has generously donated the proceeds of this book to the Fresno County Historical Society. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it's awkward to try to write a story. I don't know about other people. It's awkward for me to try to write a story of my life and the things that have happened to me and the things that I would like to see happen without it coming across too self-serving. And I didn't want anyone to feel that I did this for monetary value to myself. And then I searched, you know, if that's right, then what can I do to benefit some folks? And the Historical Society just seemed to me like a place to go.
I think it was a very wise choice, and I think they'll agree over there. So valleyhistory.org, if you want to order that book, you can go to the office on Kearney Boulevard, too, and pick one up there. And we'll mention that web address a couple times throughout the duration of this program. We're talking to Dick Johansen, who has written this book, A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation. You mentioned not wanting to just look back at the things you did and come across as bragging about them or being proud of yourself, but I think that comes across here in the book because at the end of the book, and I think you can always tell how good a book is if you cheat a little bit and flip towards the end of it and see how it wraps up the conclusion. And really, the last chunk of pages in there is encouragement to younger people, how they should conduct themselves, particularly in business. You've been a very successful businessman. And this book doesn't just look back. I think you're probably looking more to the future than you are looking back, right?
That was my goal, Paul, is to use the Library of History as a reference book to determine where you want to be tomorrow. And that's my vision of anything at all that may come from publishing my story, is that people may be able to pick up something I've placed in there and say, I could use this in my life as I go towards tomorrow. So that's kind of what it is.
Well done. And, you know, really, that's my hope for this program, the TV show that I'm trying to put together as well, that by preserving disturbing stories of men like you who lived through one of the most turbulent times in the world's history, if not the most turbulent time, and experienced everything you did, that by figuring out how you did what you did, it can inspire people my age, people younger than me, and put us on the right track. So hopefully by preserving some history and telling that to our younger people, we can create a future generation and generations to come that love our country and that love each other and really do some great things for our society. We're already at the time for our first break, so we'll step away for a moment. We'll get into the book a little bit later on, but when we come back, we'll talk about Dick's experiences growing up in Kingsburg, how he ended up in the Marine Corps, and what he did in World War II. You've heard a little taste, and you'll hear much more here on Hometown Heroes, News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Dick? That's familiar, and I've heard that a few times.
Thought it would be appropriate to hear a little bit of the Marine Corps theme that's performed by the Sounds of Freedom Band, which is actually an association of the U.S. Army group here locally that performed that at one of their recent concerts. So thanks to the USA Sounds of Freedom Band for that. Dick was in the Marine Corps, but how did that come to be? And we heard in that short piece, you graduated high school at 16?
Yeah, I was
a little bit ahead of myself.
Young
sweet,
huh? Yeah, just briefly, my birthday's in December, so there wasn't kindergarten then, so I started first grade when I was 5 3/4 or something. And then in the third grade, they asked, after December, the teachers asked my mom and dad if they could put me in the fourth grade. I said, that'll be fine. So I went in the fourth grade, and then the next fall, I went in the fifth grade. So all of a sudden, I'm really kind of 2 years ahead of myself. So
You've been ahead of the rest of us ever since, I guess.
I don't think so.
Were you itching to do something at once Pearl Harbor happened? Where were you when that happened? Do you remember when you found out?
It happened on a Sunday morning, and we were at home. And we were getting ready to go to church, and the radio was on, and boom, here comes this news of Pearl Harbor's being bombed. So that kind of messed up that day a little bit. So we stayed at home until afternoon, and then my mom and dad, I had two younger brothers, and so they actually said, well, how would you boys like to go to the movies? So they took us, we went and watched movies and went to a movie in the afternoon while they stayed home and kind of got a handle for what was going on. So that's really how that came about. With no TV and nothing but radio, Pearl Harbor seemed kind of far away, but it was very, very real. And then particularly the next day, President Roosevelt gave his talk that we were at war with Japan and Germany and Italy.
That's an interesting point you bring up about there being no TV. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I'm sure that FDR and everyone involved was thankful there was no TV because they really didn't want people to know how severe the damage had been at Pearl Harbor.
Well, that could be, Paul. That could well be. After being there later, a few years later, and still seeing some of the damage, and now looking back at old film, I don't think that any of us at home, just by the radio description of what was happening, could grasp just how big a disaster that was to our naval forces.
But it meant something to you at the time. Did you decide at that point that, you know, at some point I'm going to be serving my country in uniform?
I think the nation did, Paul. I think that was the difference. I think each of us, in our own way, realized that this was a national threat to us, and we had to figure out some way to overcome it. To young men like myself, it was going into the service. To adults, it was perhaps getting into a job producing war materiel. To others, it was making bandages or these kind of things. But
the National National Weather Service in Hanford, California, has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for West Central Murray County in Central California. This includes the city of Visalia until 5 o'clock p.m. At 4.07 p.m., National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm. This storm was located near Farmersville, or about 5 miles south of Visalia, and moving north at 35 miles per hour. The severe thunderstorm will be near Wood Lake by 4:25 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is a dangerous storm. If you are in its path, prepare immediately for damaging winds, destructive hail, and deadly cloud-to-ground lightning. People outside should move to a shelter, preferably inside a strong building, but away from windows. In addition to large hail and damaging winds, continuous cloud-to-ground lightning is occurring with this storm. Move indoors immediately. Lightning is one of nature's number one killers. Remember, if you can hear thunder, you are close enough to be struck by lightning. A severe thunderstorm watch remains in effect until 6 o'clock p.m. Sunday evening for Central California.
You during emergencies is being tested. If this had been an actual emergency, such as a flood or an earthquake, official messages would have followed the alert tone. This station serves the San Joaquin Valley local area. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
And we resume with Hometown Heroes now. A good reminder of why we're here in the first place, to inform the people of what's going on. And there is some severe weather out there, so be careful. You heard that severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 6 o'clock this evening. So let's continue now with Dick Johansson. And somewhere along the line, you decided on the Marine Corps. Was that something you had to wait to get old enough before you could do anything in the service? Did you think about the Army, the Navy, the Air Corps at that time, or were you wanting to be a Marine all that time?
No, I think in fairness, I thought of all four branches of service. There was no Air Corps then. It was still
inside
part
the
Army.
Right.
But the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard were really the four choices. And I just decided I wanted to be in the Marine Corps. And I graduated from high school at 16, so I went to UC Berkeley for a year. And I was going to be then, I was 17, and I was going to be 18 that December, and I realized that I would undoubtedly, I had my choice to enlist or be drafted, and I really wanted to be in the Marine Corps, so I stayed out of my sophomore year, and I worked with my dad in the shipyards in Alameda for just a few months until I was 18. And as my book relates, interesting story there, my birthday is on December the 17th, so I went to the Marine Corps in San Francisco and said I'd like to enlist with one caveat. I would like to at least stay home until after Christmas with my family. And they said, that's no problem. We'll do that. Sign here. So I signed and enlisted in the Marine Corps, and it wasn't too many days or weeks later I received a nice pretty envelope from the Marine Corps that says report for duty on December the 17th. So much for promises at wartime. So then I went off to boot camp in San Diego on the 17th of December and spent Christmas down there in boot camp.
You didn't check behind the recruiter's back to see those crossed fingers when he
no,
told you that.
I didn't.
So how was Christmas in boot camp?
It was fine. It was fine. We worked awfully hard. Marine Corps boot camp was really difficult because I was never in the Army or the Navy, so I can't compare. But in talking with buddies and stuff, I do think Marine Corps boot camp was much more of a challenge than the other branches was at that time.
Did you ever find yourself thinking, what did I get myself into here?
Once in a while, a little bit. The task of the drill instructors with new recruits is to turn them into Marines, to take them from just kids off the street and make Marines out of them in 10 or 12 weeks or whatever the training period was. So they were pretty tough. And once in a while I would think, how can these people be so tough and so demanding? But that was their job, and they were good at it.
Did you think at the time that it would only be a matter of time until you were splashing onto a beach somewhere in the Pacific? Is that what you expected to happen?
Oh, I think so. The Marine Corps is an amphibious organization. It's built around going ashore on beaches. The Army is more for large land areas, but the Marine Corps is designed at that time to be an amphibious force. So when you sign up for the Marine Corps, you figured at some point in time you're going to get in a little landing craft and head for the beach. So in my particular case, it was unexpected that I would be selected to learn code, to learn to be a radio operator. But even at that point in time, landing forces need radio operators with radios on their backs to establish beach communication. So even then, when I did my basic radio training, it was everything focused on landing on a beach someplace. And later on, I was asked to then go to more advanced training, and that changed the focus a little bit.
How did they pick you out for that? Did they figure out somehow that you had good ears, or you had good hand-eye coordination, or how do you think you got filtered out into that program?
Well, we took various examinations, various competency examinations, and as we went into the Marine Corps, into boot camp, to figure out what we might best where we might best serve. And for some reason, I was selected to go to this radio school. What particular trait I had that made them make that decision, Paul, I don't have the foggiest notion.
But you're not complaining that they did.
No, I'm not.
It turned out all right for you.
Yes, it did.
And eventually they sent you over to Pearl Harbor, and this would have been several years after the attacks now, but you could still see the aftermath, see where...
2 years afterwards. Mm-hmm. Two years and 1 month, really.
Mm-hmm.
The attack, of course, was December 7th in 41,
yep.
And I was there, and... No, that's incorrect. I arrived there in the first week in January in 45.
Okay, so it was 3 years.
Three years,
1 month.
Or whatever, you know.
Did that mean anything to you to be at that location knowing... This is what got the U.S. into the war, and did it seem like a historic place, hallowed ground to you at the time, or were you too busy focusing on what they were telling you to do?
No, it seemed like I had a responsibility, that this was my assignment now, was to go to the Marine Corps headquarters and then go in their radio, in their communications division and copy this code. And there was nothing, I don't think I ever had a feeling that it was anything especially historical. It was just an assignment. And I think most Marines felt that. Wherever you were, this was, you were expected to do the best you could, and this was your assignment. So,
was there any pressure with that? I mean, here you are now, and maybe you can walk our listeners through it real quick. Is exactly the mechanism that you had to follow there. Now you're receiving, and on one end Morse code,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
And, that's correct.
And then you're typing blocks of letters.
Yes.
How did that work into the message being transferred, and was it difficult to figure out, and was there any pressure that if you don't get this right, something major could be screwed up here?
There was pressure because you had to be accurate, and there were always times when you could make a mistake. There was some, and I was never involved in that, but there was a way to, there was a submarine. The submarine headquarters for the Navy was also in Pearl Harbor, and they had a similar radio group as we had in the Marine Corps at Pearl Harbor, at Marine Corps headquarters. And I understand that if we did foul up, there was a way they could communicate with those folks to make sure that the message was assembled correctly. But that's what we did. Most everything we typed would come in, and it was all blocks of code, with a few exceptions. And we'd just sit there and type those five-letter blocks. And
so you didn't even know what it meant, necessarily?
No, we didn't know what they were. But next door, in the Quonset next door, was the decoding folks. And that was, of course, high security in there, and so we didn't go in there. But
were you ever curious about that? Did you ever want to kind of peek in there, find out?
Oh,
what they're figuring out after the fact.
Occasionally you wonder what's happening and what's going on. But here again, I think it was mostly a feeling that my assignment is to do this. And if I do this correctly, then I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
And I think that is one of the hallmarks of your generation, and one of the things that I admire so much, the humility and the awareness of I'm a part of something bigger than myself. It's not all about me and what I can do. It's about how great we can be together when we just do what we're asked to do. And it sounds like that was your mindset at the time.
That was our task. That's why we enlisted, is so that we could create an environment where we could win this war and get back home again. And the way to do that is each person, for each person to do their job as best they can.
Amen. Well, it's time for another commercial break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the one message that Dick did not have to decode, but that is one that he remembers crystal clearly still today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes this Sunday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lattler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to the program. We continue now with Dick Johansen, author of the new book, A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation. You can order that online at valleyhistory.org, or you can pick them up in person at the Fresno Historical Society on Kearney Boulevard. Proceeds from the book are going to the Historical Society. And I've just been reading through some of it today sitting here, and it's very easy to read through, very straightforward and honest. And towards the end of the book, Dick really gets into what he hopes that younger people will espouse, the kind of values that they'll hold, and gives us some real good nuggets that we'll talk about in a little while. Right now, though, let's get back to where he was in the spring of 1945, which was Pearl Harbor. He's a young Marine, and as it turns out, you never had to make one of those amphibious landings, which I know that you're very thankful for. But in April of 1945, you did experience a very memorable day, April 12th, 1945. I'm sure that you haven't forgotten one second of us. Walk us through what took place there and why it's still so powerful to you today.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, my job was just to sit kind of hours during my shift in the radio control room where we typed these messages coming in from mostly from Washington, and they were all in code, and we didn't know really what was in them, but occasionally they would break the code and send one in English. And so on this particular day, this is here come this English message, and the message stated that it was from the Secretary of Navy, James Forrestal. He says, I regret to advise you that President Franklin D. Roosevelt passed away today. And he has been replaced, or President, our new president is former Vice President Harry S. Truman. And then there was some information in there about the flags would be lowered for a period of time and a few other things. So that thing to me was just to realize that I was privileged, if that's the right word, on the death of a president. But I was able to be a tiny little part in the grand scheme of things, for the folks at the Marine Corps headquarters in Pearl Harbor to type this message. That was meaningful to me, Paul. That really touched me. And keep in mind that Franklin Roosevelt had just begun his fourth term as president.
He's really the only president you ever knew.
That's right. He was elected in 1932. Mm. And so only president, because in 32 I was only 7 years old. So he was the president I knew. And the interesting thing that followed that, of course, was that because he was such a dominant figure in our country, in our government, that the vice president was relatively unknown. So when Vice President Truman became president, he was a big question mark. And I think the nation kind of wondered, our leader is gone, what are we going to do now? And so in the months and even the years that followed that, President Truman proved that he was entirely capable of being an excellent president in this country. And he was an excellent president.
And he had to go from 0 to 60 pretty quick. I read some reports
about
how FDR really hadn't clued him in on much at all. He'd barely been vice president for a few months, and FDR hadn't told him anything about the nuclear weapon research, the A-bombs that they had. And, boy, I guess he had to get up on that horse rather quickly, but
he did.
Thank goodness he did a good job.
Yeah, he did, because he was in, as I understand from my reading of history, too, that President Truman, or Vice President Truman, didn't know anything about this atomic weapon right. business, and all of a sudden it's his decision whether we're going to drop it on Hiroshima on Nagasaki, and he decided that's what we had to do. So, and as terrible as that was in loss of lives, the lives lost were probably less there than, assuredly less there than they would have been had the Marines and the Army too had to go, try to go ashore and
invade Japan.
Yeah.
And your life might have been one of those saved by that, because you would have been next in line to jump out of that radio room and go onto a beach on mainland Japan.
I would surely have been getting salt water on my shoes. I know that.
As it turned out, the bombs were dropped, as we all know, and the war came to an end. But your time in the service wasn't over, and you ended up learning a little bit of a new language somewhere in Asia. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was interesting, because the war ended, and naturally, by that time, I'd been transferred away from Marine Corps headquarters over to the 4th Marine Division on Maui. The 4th Marine Division was participated in Iwo Jima, and the casualty rate there was really substantial. So when they came back to their home base on Maui, the word was out to throughout the Marine Corps that those that hadn't seen combat had to get over in a combat outfit. So I left the radio group at Pearl Harbor and was transferred over to the what we call the Joint Assault Task Force, Joint Assault Signal Corps, a part of the 4th Marine Division on Maui, to go back to learn how to become a field operator again with a radio pack on my back. So, and our function as a JASCO was to be among the first units to go ashore to establish beach communications. And there were quite a few, they needed quite a few replacements, which is why I was there, because their casualty list on Iwo Jima was pretty substantial.
What was that like once you got over there and saw what you saw? Was that a lot different than what you'd been doing?
Quite a bit different. At Pearl Harbor, naturally, we lived in barracks, and we had meals in kitchens and dining rooms, and we were transported to our working stations in vehicles on highways, and all of a sudden here we are at the 4th Marine Division. We're living in tents, and we're eating in tent mess halls. We have no hot water. I'm 6 months without a hot shower, so I know what that is all about. And so it was just different. And we had pit latrines, so it was a different world. But the people are the same. Wherever you go, people are the same. And the Marines there were those that came back were just calm. They were thankful to be back.
Mm-hmm.
They were they didn't talk much about Iwo, and those of us that were new didn't ask any questions. And so we just realized that our job wasn't finished, and it wouldn't be finished until we figured out somehow the nation of Japan had to surrender. So everything was focused on what's the next step.
Do you remember where you were when you heard about the surrender?
Oh yeah, we were there. I remember that. Yeah, we were there at right there at our base on Maui, and the announcement the announcement came earlier, of course, that Europe had surrendered.
Right.
So then all the focus became in the Pacific, and then we heard about the bombing of Hiroshima one day, and then I think it was 2 days later. I think they bombed Nagasaki. I could be a little bit wrong there.
It wasn't very far apart, August of 1945.
And it wasn't very many days after that. Then the announcement came that Japan had surrendered. And that was a big celebration all over the camp. And
I imagine so.
There were a lot of Marines had some special beverages stashed away in the bottom of their sea bags. that all of a sudden were broken out. So it was party time for a lot of folks.
They knew what they were saving them for. Mm-hmm. They recognized it when it got there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, guess what? You get to go to China. And you mm-hmm. said, China? What am I going to do in China?
Yeah, well, that's right. Because then the question became, well, who gets to go home and how quickly can we go home and who can't go home? Well, they came up with a fair point system that you had so many points for combat time.
Right.
And you had so many points for months overseas. And if your total was so much, you'd go home. If it wasn't, you stayed a while. Well, because I had only been over there about a year, I didn't have enough points to come home. So I was transferred out to Guam and stayed there for about a month and then reassigned from Guam up to Tsingtao, China. And that's where I stayed for 9 months. And when I got to Tsingtao, China, then I was back doing the same type of radio work I was doing at Pearl Harbor, with working with much faster code and with my typewriter. Mm. But my task was a little different because everything was in English. And I was actually copying. My job was to prepare the newscasts for the Armed Forces radio station. So I would type these stories and tweak them a little bit to make them maybe more easy, more
conversational,
listenable or whatever.
To understand.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's what I did then for 9 months. Huh? And then finally, about August of 1946, then my turn came to come home. So that was an exciting day, too, so, yeah.
And I imagine you probably hadn't seen your family in quite some time.
No, it had been a long time. It had been, by the time I got home in just about the 1st of September, I think it was, in 46, I'd been gone. I saw them, the last time I saw them was the end of 44. So it was about 2 years, yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you remember what that felt like?
You betcha. I'll never forget that either, because in those days, we didn't take airplanes. You couldn't fly because there was no air service for basic military people, and there was no train service, you know, from San Diego to Fresno. There was a train, but it'd take forever to get here. So everybody hitchhiked, and in those days, people with automobiles, civilians, would pick up military people.
You see a man in uniform, you got to trust him.
Yeah, surely. So that's the way we traveled, and that's the way I got home. So actually, I left San Diego discharged in late afternoon, and I don't remember what day of the week it was, but I know by the time I got home, it was about 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. So here I'm walking down the little street of Kingsburg from the highway to my house, to our house. And I remember that very distinctly. And my mother was out watering her flowers because it was end of August, 1st September. And our little dog, who hadn't seen me in 2 years, saw me coming and just about leaped out of her skin. I never realized a dog could have a memory like that.
Uh-huh.
That's another one of those memories, like typing the FDR
mm-hmm.
Death message that will never go away from me. There's little Rex coming running after me and jumping up and yelping and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Had your family known you were about to arrive?
Yeah, they knew I was home.
Yeah.
They knew I was home, but they didn't know exactly when I was going to get home. Mm-hmm. So it was a surprise for them.
Rex let them know pretty loudly and clearly.
That's right.
Well, that's a great story, great story. We need to get in our final commercial break here. When we come back, we'll focus more on this book, A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation, the generation of which Dick Johansen is a part and such a large contributing part. And we'll hear some of the nuggets from this book and again tell you where you can get it. As Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
We have about 10 minutes left here with Dick Johansen. The time always goes by way too quickly, and hopefully you'll get a chance to find this book and spend a little more time with Dick and his wise words here. A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation is the book. Proceeds go to the Fresno Historical Society. You can order copies online at valleyhistory.org or at the Society's offices. And one of my favorite pages in here is where it talks about the elation of inspiration. It's little nuggets, little quotes that Dick has picked up over the years. And I think procrastinate now is a pretty wise one. I like that. But there's a lot of great little quotes in here. But I think more of the lasting things that you have in here. You have an explanation of why you did this, and I think I'll read to our listeners really quickly just a little bit of this and set you up to tell us why it's so important. He talks towards the end here about establishing standards, and this is quoting the book. It is valuable here to redefine and clarify some of the tenets that I've tried to follow throughout my life. I do so with the realization that some of what I shall write may be construed as self-serving. However, it could also be considered self-serving if I merely presented to those who may read this journal only a recapitulation of events and awards in my life without trying to identify the reasons for them. Why was I asked to serve in these public positions? Mine was not the biggest business around, nor the most important. Ours was not a well-known family name. I certainly was not a seeker of recognition. While admittedly a borderline Adonis, I would modestly hesitate to call myself exceptionally handsome. Now, that's some clever writing there, Dick.
You like that.
But basically what you're getting to here is this book is not about you. This book is about what you feel is your responsibility to tell us, the people younger than you and future generations, some of the keys to the path that you've led and what you think they can benefit by incorporating in their own lives, right?
That's right, Paul. My purpose isn't to really tell anybody what they need to do. What I would like to do is share with people what I believe and offer them some suggestions as to things they might consider in their own lives, and most do. So that's what I've tried to do in this particular session. I've listed a number of points, and the starting point for me in any relationship is trust. And I just think that that before anyone can become credible at all, they have to be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And before you can really establish a good relationship with someone else, you have to be able to trust them. And everything fundamentally, sooner or later, comes back to trust and belief. And
that's something I'm sure was developed as a young boy growing up, but certainly once you got to the Marine Corps, if you couldn't trust the guy next to you, you know, who could you trust? Trust was inherent in what you were doing over there.
That's true. That's one of the tenets, one of the basic creeds of the Marine Corps. Semper Fidelis, for example, always faithful.
Always faithful,
and
Semper Fi.
And that means that's trust.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be faithful if you don't have trust.
That's right.
So
you say in here, in A Passion for Stewardship, mm-hmm. Legacy of a Generation, trust and be trusted. And then your next bullet point here is have some heroes. And you're not talking about the guy who's making a basket or swinging a golf club necessarily.
No, I'm talking about civic heroes here, or even public heroes, and I've purposely refrained from trying to mention too many names in this book because if I got into that, the first thing I do is leave out somebody I should have. But I felt people like, I did mention, for example, Leon Peters, who's, I think, an icon here for a fellow that started really on a farm and built a business. And in doing that, he shared what he was able to do. And people grasped Leon's standards. And people trusted Leon Peters. Mm. And the same way with Lou Eaton, when he established that. He's for most people know it, but he's really the inspiration behind the Fresno Metropolitan Museum.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with the McClatchy organization when the Fresno Bee moved away and was able to get that building. So
you saw the vision and the desire to give back that those people had, and it's something that you modeled your own life after.
And Mr. Bob Duncan is one of my contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
The same way. He developed a very successful business, but been very generous in what he was able to do with some of the rewards that came to him, and by his personal conduct, also is someone that's inspiring, and people trust him. See?
And there's the next point here, and we're not going to have time to get through all of your points here, but it's an interesting contrast to the last two that we heard, but I think it's equally as important, which is acknowledge your frailties. Don't be afraid to admit your mistakes. I guess that kind of helps people trust you a little more, doesn't it?
I think so. I just feel there's nothing wrong with making a mistake. I worked for a man one time that said, if you don't make any mistakes, I know you're not doing anything.
And not taking any risks.
Yeah, he says, I'll expect you to make some mistakes if you're doing your job, because you're out there trying to make things better. So I think that I think if you goof up, say, I made a mistake, and get on with it. I think it's important that we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses. And it's just as important that you recognize your weaknesses and identify them and try to improve them.
Turn them into strengths.
Is to go around bloated with your what you think your strengths are.
Amen to that. Is there one thing in here? I know that when you write an entire book like this, and I'm sure there's a lot you left out of here that would have been valuable for some of us too, but is there one thing that if anyone reads this book, you really hope is the message that that person gets?
Yeah, there very definitely is. And I've my little paragraph heading is Don't Just Care, Act. I listened to an inspirational talk one time many years ago, and the speaker said, don't just care. He says, who cares if we care? If we care without action is nothing. So I think what I would urge is that let's define things we care about. And once you have that definition, then define a way to act to improve them or to change them or whatever needs to be done or to participate in those things. So just to sit back and be a critic isn't as impressive to me as someone that says, I think this could be fixed, and here's how I think maybe we can fix it. And there are so many organizations in town, in the community, in the region, that are dedicated to try to make this a better society. And we have to get into that. And that's what I hope young people like you and your contemporaries can get out of a book from an older person like me, is that back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, I think we had a greater feeling of participating, mm-hmm. and wanting to create a new society for ourselves, wanted to make ourselves better. Because keep in mind, in those days, we didn't have so many help programs either, and I think they're valuable. So people were
you didn't have any choice but to make it happen.
You had to go out and figure out how you're going to make a change. So to me, don't just care, act is probably my little gem of
I love it.
Wisdom.
I love it, and that certainly reflects a passion for stewardship, which is the title of the book, A Passion for Stewardship, The Legacy of a Generation. Again, you can get it at valleyhistory.org. And, Dick, I know that that's something that you're not just writing about. It's something that you've lived, and you've been giving back to our valley for so long. And I know the people that will read this book will be inspired and will take the time not to just to care but to act. So thank you for setting the bar high for us. Thank you for your service to our country and to our valley and for being here today.
Thank you for letting me be with you.
My pleasure. That's Dick Johansen. This is Hometown Heroes. We'll be back next Sunday on News Talk 580 KMJ.